Only three more killing days to Christmas. The chief's gonna love cracks like that.
Do you think, sir, we might have a psychopath on our hands?
My father's just been murdered. I can't concentrate.
Well, you know me, mate. Ducking and weaving, ducking and weaving.
What's happened?
Sharon, the model you met last night, was attacked in the street.
Attacked? Who'd attack her?
Maybe you can tell me. You recall how she was dressed.
Santa Claus.
Do you like me on your knee all bouncing and raring to go?
Her father was killed at the Christmas party.
Part of the Christmas party, oh Jesus.
You were arrested for indecent exposure.
Indecent? I'm a professional.
Do you like your hands all over me? Caressing me?
Ducking and weaving, ducking and weaving.
You know, it's Christmas Day. Goodwill towards men and all that.
Ducking and weaving, ducking and weaving.
With all the trimmings, Luigi.
I do remember one thing. His eyes. They sort of smiled behind the mask. If I saw those eyes again, I'd recognize him. If he was smiling.
Hey everyone, my name is Amanda Reyes, and welcome to the debut episode of a podcast with a working title of the One by One Cast. We're still working things out here, but we wanted to get together to talk about slasher movies, and I'm joined here by my co-host, Ewan Kant. Hi, Ewan.
Hi, Amanda. I'm delighted.
I am too. We're really excited to be here. So a little behind the curtains before we get started into all of what we're doing on this episode. Ewan and I have been talking about doing a podcast for a long, long time because we're both kind of madly fanatical about slashers. And when we end up talking, we talk forever about them. And we've actually done a couple of commentaries together, including a commentary for the film we're going to be talking about today, which is Don't Open Till Christmas. And so we thought, what a perfect film to begin our podcast with, because this is a really strange film. It's a really interesting film. It's a really fascinating film. It's a flawed and complicated movie as well. And it's one that after we did the commentary, we realized there's still a lot to talk about. And so we decided, let's just finally do this thing. And so I think we're just going to dive in. And I think the best way to start maybe might be to just talk about why slashers? So, Ewan, what is it about slashers that you love so much?
I guess, I mean, obviously, my lead-in was horror films. I was, you know, from, I think, five or six, I was taping Child's Play off TV awesome. and watching that on Nightmare on Elm Street. But basically, kind of any horror I could get my hands on. And, of course, amongst that was your Friday the 13th, your Halloweens, even your Burnings, the Slayers. And I think as I sort of started to take more of an interest in kind of unearthing the kind of lesser seen films, I just sort of found myself gravitating more and more towards the slasher genre. I always cite a website, which I'm not sure if it's still around or not, called The Terror Trap. Yes. And I was big into, I was obviously kind of well on my way to, you know, loving slashers at that point. But yeah, maybe about sort of 15, 20 years ago, I discovered the Terror Trap, and they had a kind of a page called Slasher Frenzy about kind of some of the lesser seen slashers. So things that I, you know, hadn't really come across before, like Curtains, Just Before Dawn, House on Sorority Row, you know, all kind of stuff that you know, I was you know, able to discover through you know, the wonder of the internet. And I just became quite in a similar way, actually, to it's quite similar actually to when I was about 13 or 14. I got a copy of the Dark Side magazine that had a special, one of their many specials on the Video Nasties. And, you know, they had like a blow-by-blow account, like a little synopsis on each one. And so that became my kind of hit list, my sort of shopping list of Video Nasties to track down. And then in a similar kind of way, this kind of, this page kind of became my Bible for slasher movies to track down. And I just got more and more into and feverish about, you know, picking up VHS off eBay for these slasher films that hadn't had a disc release yet. Quite often, you know, that was one of the kind of the allure of them, was that they hadn't had, many of them hadn't at that point, you know, obviously since, you know, a bunch of them have had DVD Blu-ray releases, many of which I'm very happy to say that I've been able to have a hand in my sort of professional life. But yeah, then at that point, it just kind of became a bit of an obsession for me, really. And, you know, it's the same with any kind of like film trend, you know, like you kind of, you, once you sort of start engaging with something, you want to see more and more. And why do they appeal to me? I guess there's that kind of, I've always found from a young age kind of horror a place of comfort. You know, we've spoken before about, you know, comfort horror movies.
Yeah.
And that sounds odd to a lot of, you know, the uninitiated, let's say, but it really is, there's a huge comfort for me in horror. And I guess kind of that's kind of even more so with slasher films, where you have, to an extent, you kind of, you know, you have a a sort of a set list of, you know, there's a kind of a structure to follow and conventions. But it's also exciting to see how, you know, different films kind of take that and what they do with it and how successfully or unsuccessfully they handle those kind of conventions.
Absolutely. Yeah, that's the thing I always talk about. Like, there's a blueprint, but it's like what they do within the blueprint that makes the film so good, you know, and never bad. There are very few slashers I think I dislike.
Yeah. We can come on to that at some point. We'll get to our... But again, it's like you said, I just like, generally with like a couple of very few exceptions, like I always find something in slasher films to sort of get me to come back to it.
Yeah, you know, I will say you and I are, there's a little age gap there, and so I didn't have the internet when slashers came into my life. And actually, I was alive and remember the golden age of slashers, but I saw a couple of them. Like, I saw Halloween when I was very young. I was like 8 or 9 maybe. And I saw Friday the 13th when I was like 10. But they terrified me so much, I couldn't watch them till I was older. But I remember really well, like, going to school, and there was always some kid who had like a super cool brother who took him to like the slasher film that came out that weekend. And we'd be waiting for the bus, and he'd be like, dude, I just saw Hell Night. It's really good. And like, they would tell us all about the movies. And actually, when I was 10, I think it was about 10, Prom Night aired on network television. And I watched it and didn't watch it. It got really scary, so I think I watched like the first half of it. But next day we had show and tell. And literally like half the class got up and talked about Lou's decapitation scene. You know? And it was like this big thing to talk about at school. And so it was always kind of there in my life. And like you, I guess I was watching a lot of horror. But slashers kind of, they were so big at the time, you couldn't help but run into one anyway. And I started, when I became a teenager, watching them a little more and more. And then in my early 20s, I saw Maniac. And that just opened up a floodgate for me, because I'd never seen anything like that. And it was absolutely terrifying. And it gave me this kind of feeling that I never had before, or since, to be honest, watching a horror movie, particularly that scene with the nurse in the subway. And also Tom Savini blowing off his own head. Like, it was just, it just put me in this place. And I thought, ooh, I want this adrenaline rush again. And so I started just renting these movies voraciously. And I found that I love them. And like you, Dark Side was actually another gateway for me, because I didn't know anything about the video nasties. And I would read about people getting their movies confiscated when they would go to other countries and then come back. And there were these lists of films, you know, that had been banned in England. And that blew my mind, because in America, you've never heard of such a thing. And so I thought, these must be the ultimate film. So it kind of branched me off into cannibal movies and all kinds of stuff. And then the internet came, and like you, I discovered Terror Trap. And of course, The Hysteria Lives, and was a big site for me and still is. And it just, I found that I loved slashers. They are not always genuinely scary, but the first time I would watch one, particularly when I was in my early 20s, there was always something about them. And I don't know why those films in particular hit a nerve for me, but I think it's because, even though they're really crazy and fantastical, there's an element of like reality to them, and this kind of idea of like being stalked and killed is like a real thing. And so I think that that kernel of that always sat with me, and it could be really effective. And they're just fun. And as I got more comfortable with like the blueprint of them, then I kind of like could lay back. Some movies are always going to be genuinely scary. Like Just Before Dawn will always be really scary. Movies like Hide and Go Shriek are scary the first time out for me, but then afterwards they just become like kind of fun, you know?
Mm.
And so I guess it just depends on the film, but I found that I really loved them. And as I got older, like you, they became a source of comfort because they do have this structure. And also because some of them are super 80s.
Mm-hmm.
And I can't avoid anything that's super 80s. I mean, I'm just going to love it. So, you know, because yeah. that was my childhood.
Yeah. I just think there's so many things that kind of come together with the slasher movie. And there is also just something about that specific period of kind of, you know, very early 80s. I mean, obviously, I love the full gamut, and I even like some more recent stuff. But, you know, to pick an example, something like, you know, Death Screams from 1982, you know, I mean, that's, you know, what, 60, 70% kids, quote unquote, wandering around a fairground with, you know, very little slashering to be had. But it's just kind of, it sort of captures, these things kind of capture a time and a place, often better than, you know, the kind of bigger budget stuff did.
Yeah,
because they're working, definitely. You know, especially these regional American horror films, they're kind of working with, you know, like local cast and crew, you know, they're using what they had available, and you just get a real sense of a time and a place with these films that you wouldn't get, you know, I don't think you get in some of the kind of bigger budget stuff.
No, I agree. I love regional horror just because it's so unhyper-stylized that I'm like, wow, we all look like that. You know what I mean? And like, it brings back a lot of memories. Like, Night Screams is a really good example of, like, a great regionally shot horror film that I think is much better than it might get credit for. But also, it's got, like, it has actors in it. It's got somebody from The Karate Kid and stuff. But they just look like kids to me. You know what I mean? Like, that you would see at your own high school. Maybe a little older than that. But, like, you know, people you knew.
And you just want to be a sweetheart dancer.
I am in my heart. Absolutely.
So
what I wanted to mention real quick, because you had talked about like how you worked on some of these releases, and I guess we didn't really preface who we are. And so I'm more of a slasher fan, and I've done commentaries, thanks to you, on some slashers. But you are like kind of a bigwig in the world of revitalizing these films. And so you used to work for Arrow, and through Arrow you released a lot of amazing films. One that you and I worked on together was The Prey, which I know is a film that we both adore, like nobody's business. And now you're working for Vinegar Syndrome, and you have had, you and I think Justin Kurzweil are two of like the leading, I don't know how to word it, slasher historians. Like, you are the people that are bringing the most love to these films and kind of revitalizing them and bringing them back to the forefront and kind of, and everybody on Justin's podcast, which is called The Hysteria Continues, I don't want to dismiss them as well, but you two in particular have just done an amazing job like keeping these movies alive. And so I think it's really important, the stuff that you're doing and that we talk about it, and we promote your work here as well. I don't want to get stuck just shamelessly self-promoting, but but it isn't, your work is important, and you're doing things that nobody else has done, and you're giving love to films that nobody else is going to give this kind of love to. And a prime example of that is Don't Open Till Christmas, which the extras are ridiculous, and you really came through. And so I guess before we get into the film, and maybe this is a way to branch into the kind of things you do, I don't know if you want to talk a little bit about how you came up with the idea for the extras that you did, and how you approach things when you put these kind of discs together, if that's a question at all.
Well, I guess I'll be a bit candid here, and well, for a start, and we will kind of get into this. You know, I mean, obviously your first port of call with any release is to try and get as many of the people involved in the movie, you know, on your release. In the case of this film, obviously, a lot of people are no longer with us. So that was kind of an initial challenge. I will say, without naming names, I'll tell you after, a couple of people did decline. which is, you know, absolutely fair enough. And honestly, I'm thrilled when I reach out to people and, you know, they are A, receptive, and B, actually enthusiastic. And that's not always the case, you know, and you have to take that with a pinch of salt, you know. A lot of these films, you know, are 30, 40 years old, you know, people have gone on to leave the business, do other things. And, you know, for God's sake, people have their own shit going on, you know.
Yeah.
And here I come out of the woodwork saying, you know, from a company they've probably never heard of because they're not in that kind of, in that realm anymore, saying, oh, do you remember this film from 40 years ago? But that said, yeah, I was very happy with who we were able to get. I think we got some really good insights. So we were able to get Alan Birkinshaw, who was kind of brought in after the kind of the initial shoot, to rewrite and then reshoot a lot of the film. I think he said about 30, 40 minutes. So that was fantastic. We've got a wonderful kind of archival piece with him, like a career spanning piece with him as well, because he's had a very interesting career. Yeah. I have to give a shout out to Eugenio Ercolani for that. He was an extras producer extraordinaire, and that comes courtesy of him. We were able to get Caroline Munro. Obviously she has, you know, a brief but incredibly memorable turn in the film, performing her song Warrior of Love. And she provides a really, really nice, insightful piece, kind of talking kind of about Don't Open Till Christmas, but obviously she wasn't in that she was on it for like a day, I think. But she talks, you know, she went on to work with Dick Randall and Slaughter High and some of the same people. And she talks generally about kind of some of her more sort of slasherific roles. So that was fantastic. We actually have an interview with Sir Edmund Purdom, who's the star and nominal director of the film. We managed to get an interview with one of his daughters, Lynn Purdom, who actually has written a book about her father called Hollywood Garage, which refers to the fact that at one point Edmund and his first wife, because he ended up having four wives in total, he lived with her when he first moved to Hollywood in a garage. So that's where that title comes from. But yeah, we kind of originally wanted to do more of an expansive piece about Edmund Purdom. We can talk a bit more about him. But, you know, we felt that there was kind of scope to do kind of a, you know, a larger thing with various participants and filmmakers, because, you know, he started out as kind of being tipped in the 50s as, you know, one of the, like a you know, breakout star in Hollywood. And then due to scandal, he ended up fleeing to Rome and ending up in, you know, peplum sword and sandal movies, and then progressed into the most loving way possible, kind of lower grade fare, which, you know, culminates in his appearance in Don't Open Till Christmas. But yeah, so I felt it was really important to get something covering his career, and I think we got a really nice piece with his daughter talking about, yeah, you know, her kind of just very candid, kind of complicated relationship with her father. So I was really happy with all of that. Obviously, the commentary that we did, that's our third commentary together after The Prey and Phantom of the Mall. You know, I think you slightly undersold yourself calling yourself a slasher fan there. I mean, you're kind of, in my eyes, one of the leading, you know, slasher movie academics, and, you know, that's why it's really exciting to hopefully get this going with you and be having these conversations, because, you know, I think you're my favorite person to talk to about slasher movies, and you always provide insights that I certainly haven't had. So
I'm good at pulling shit out of the air and running with it.
Well, underselling yourself again. But anyway, so there's the commentary, which I'm very happy with. Love your insights on that. Some really interesting stuff in there, and so much stuff to talk about on this film, which again, we're going to be doing some of that here today. And then to top it off, we did a location piece for the film, and I'm known for being a fan of location pieces. I managed to spin a location piece on The Prey out of about two recognizable locations, I think. but that was more about, you know, the fact that you know, I was fortunate enough to be able to convince final girl Debbie Thurston to come with me to Idlewild, where the film was shot. So it was also kind of about that, and it was almost kind of like a mini doc about that, with a couple of recognizable locations thrown in. And so this Don't Open Till Christmas being, you know, a London shot film, and me being a born Londoner, it was just an absolute no-brainer for me to do that. And through I mean, some of the locations are quite readily recognizable. There's like Covent Garden, which is, you know, a famous tourist spot in central London, Portobello Road, which is obviously the famous antiques market, you know, popularized by Notting Hill and sung about in Bedknob and Broomsticks. So those are kind of like the obvious ones. But then there's a great website that I'll give a shout out to called Real Street, R-E-E-L, and they had actually done a lot of there was quite an extensive coverage on this film, and people had they'd done before and afters of many of the locations, so that was like indispensable for us being able to identify lots of the locations. And most of it is all kind of within sort of like a square mile kind of area in like central London. So we had a lot of fun just, you know, like we just go from one, and we can talk about those a bit more, but you just go film on one corner where, you know, Kelly Baker is, you know, captured by the killer. And then round the corner from that is, you know, the opening, the little close where they filmed the opening scene where the couple in the car are killed. So it was all just kind of, you just walk around the corner and there's the next thing. And it was, yeah, so that was a lot of fun. And yeah, any excuse to just kind of goof around and do something silly in front of the camera as well is what I enjoy. So yeah, so that's probably a bit more in depth than you asked for, but yeah, that's sort of how we came about creating the extras for this.
This is such an oddball movie, and I can't imagine anybody kind of doing this sort of in-depth retrospective on it, and also untangling sort of the complicated history of the film, which is at this point semi-well known, but also there's a lot of stuff that you uncovered. One thing you forgot to mention was clips of the work print that are on there. And that kind of the film structure, which I don't think we talked about on the commentary, is a little bit different than it is in the work print. And it's actually really interesting. So like the Monroe, well, we should just jump into the film. So for people who haven't seen Don't Open Till Christmas yet, the basic premise is that somebody with smiling eyes is going and killing Santa Claus, got people dressed as Santa Claus, about 3 or 4 days before Christmas. So in a 72-hour period, like 17 people get murdered, I think, by the Chestnut Bandit, as he's called, by the newspapers, which is a crazy name for a serial killer, but okay. And within that 72 hours, not only are we watching like a string of Santas that we know nothing about, except they're dressed up like Santa Claus, but we're also getting immersed in kind of like a love triangle that sort of gets forgotten about. And this crazy brother relationship, and like a lot of other things that kind of come in and out of the film, with a lot of red herrings. And some interesting commentary, I think, about women in the film. The more I think about the movie, the more I feel like I want to talk about this. And I did it a little on the commentary, but I'm really interested in the three women in the movie that are, like, I would say not the leads, because Pat Astley, who plays the, I don't know what her character's name is.
Sharon.
Sharon. She's in two scenes, but she's actually really important. And of course, Kelly Baker, who we think is going to be the final girl. And then we have another sort of final girl played by Melinda Main. And then they're really interesting. And all of this happens in this very hackneyed, choppy kind of way that makes the film really unique and a lot of fun. But I think for you and I, what was so compelling about it was that the more we started looking into the film, the more it became something that we loved. I don't know if that's the right way to word it.
Yeah, I think, yeah, I mean, just to interject, I think, you know, and what I guess I didn't add earlier when we were talking about our love of slasher movies is it's as much what happened behind camera as is in front of the camera. And it's just kind of heightened with, you know, low budget, movies. And so, yeah, for, you know, I mean, one of the reasons, you know, I became so besotted. I mean, I loved the Mutilator anyway, but one of the reasons I became so besotted with it and ended up making a feature length doc about it was the whole story behind it. And I'm sure we'll cover that another time. Well, at least we better.
Yes.
But yes, with this one, like you said, it's as we were saying just before we came on air. You know, it's kind of it's sometimes you do a lot of research on a film and you're kind of done with it. Whereas I've got it playing now in the background, and it's just the more I know about it, the more I want to rewatch it because you can see all the seams, and you know, the first time round and you have no idea what went on behind the scenes. It's all just sort of what the fuck's going on. But the more you know about it, the more you can start to pick things apart. And it's, you know, to be honest, even with all the research we did on it, we still haven't quite illuminated things fully. You know, we've definitely made some good inroads, but there's still elements of it that are kind of an enigma.
Yeah, there are, and there's some, like, for instance, well, I guess we'll talk through the film, but like there were four directors, just to give people background if they haven't listened to the commentary. There were f supposedly four directors on the film. It started with Edmond Purdom, and then at some point, Derek Ford came in, who was the screenwriter, as well as Alan Birkinshaw, who directed a huge chunk of it apparently, and also Ray Self, who's credited as the editor, and who also was a really fascinating guy who started out in B movies but ended up becoming kind of an archivist and curator of classic films. And then Edwin Perdomo showed up somewhere at the end, I guess, and wrapped things up for everybody. And so it's very complicated, and it leads to the structure being sort of where things start and end. And I was making a joke to you about how Jerry Sundquist's character, Cliff, even though he's the biggest jerk in the film, he somehow survives it. And you're like, you mean he got forgotten about? Which is essentially what happened, right? Because
Yeah,
there's a
I have to keep going back to it because there's bits where I'm just like, does he just disappear? And then you go back and you're like, yeah, he does, you know,
He
and
does. And there's a total love triangle being built at the beginning of the film. And what's really interesting is Jerry Sundquist's character kind of comes in and out with the change. So I don't know if you noticed, but when Edwin Prudhomme's character first shows up at Kate and Cliff's apartment, it's a totally different apartment than the apartment Kate gets killed in. And
Do you know
why?
what? I've literally, I know you did mention that last time we spoke. I did not clock that. That's why we need your keen eye on these things. But yeah, you're absolutely right. And yeah, okay, sorry, carry on.
That's why I think, like, so he kind of is symbolic of the apartment. Like, as things change, I think of all the characters in the film, Cliff is most sort of symbolic of the changes that are happening as the film's progressing. And I think maybe Kate's hair changes a little too. But like, it's you can tell that there's meant to be a more solid love triangle, and it's kind of an interesting story because both of them, although it's clearly not Cliff because he was at the first murder and clearly not the murderer, so it's ridiculous that Inspector Harris even thinks that he's a suspect. But the idea of her being involved with two red herrings is kind of interesting to me, and the way she sort of moves towards Inspector Harris. And one thing I didn't mention in the commentary is that Kate solves the mystery, not the other cop, the pal that works with Inspector Harris, who thinks it's Inspector Harris. And Inspector Harris constantly diminishes the female characters throughout the film.
Well,
And
they both the well, kind of all the male characters do in a way, don't they?
they
But
do. And the
I'm just
women.
watching the scene where Sergeant Powell, you know, where Kate is you know, saying that she's looked into Inspector Harris's background, and Sergeant Powell just says, you know, it says something about, you know, the register of births and deaths is not the way, or something like that.
Yes, and then it turns out it was, because she figured it all out. And
yeah.
And so, and then the other two women that are in it, Sharon, who is like this nude model, and as well as Experienced Girl, played by Kelly Baker, they're wanting to like work, and they're being held off from being able to do their work because they are sex workers, and I think they're sort of treated as such, right? Mm-hmm. And also there's this scene where Pal totally writes off one of the victims because he got killed in that booth that where yes. he was watching her dance, and she, Kelly Baker, the Experienced Girl, says, you know, he seemed like such a lovely man or something like that. And he's like, they always do. Yeah. And it's like, oh my God, that's, and even her reaction to him is like, wow, what an awful thing to say about a man who got murdered. And so I think it's really interesting. And I don't think Dick Randall or Derek Ford or anybody involved in the film were setting out to write kind of these extra dynamic female characters, but they kind of rise up out of the crop of characters we have in the film as like being the most worthy and intelligent people in the movie. And so I think that's so interesting, because one of the things I talked about on the commentary was how this movie is different and not different in that it has a lot of male characters being murdered, but it does still
Exclusively. Well, it's odd actually, isn't it? It's not, I mean, when you mentioned, when we were discussing recently about Kelly Baker's character not making it, I couldn't remember, so I went back, and it's sort of ambiguous because she's obviously we're going to spoil the hell out of this film, she kills Alan Lake is the killer, she kills his character, but at the end he jumps up, and at that moment Edmund Purdom's character kind of is awaken from what suggests it's a nightmare, so it's not, it's kind of ambiguous, but it still ends on a downbeat note for her. So I guess, yeah, like, you know, you're saying it's pretty much exclusively male victims, apart from, you know, the question about whether or not Kelly Baker is killed at the end.
Yeah.
Oh, sorry, and of course Belinda Mayne as well. So yes. It's a bit kind of all over the place in that sense.
But also I think it's interesting because while it's unlike a lot of slashers in that it's like 90% male victims, it also still has these really dynamic females, and slasher films are known for having pretty strong female leads. And although I think Kate's character is kind of thankless, she's interesting, but it's really Kelly Baker's role as the dancer that stands out to me as like, and Sharon, played by Pat Astley, as like these really interesting female characters, and two women who work in the sex industry who aren't ashamed of it and who are apparently really good at what they do, and they want to work, and they're constantly being told that they can't because of this and that, and the police are completely impotent, they're not very good at what they do. Pal totally gets the killer wrong. And he spends the entire time pursuing Inspector Harris, and then it ends up leading to the death of Kate. So, like, and Cliff is just Cliff. Like, so the hills that Cliff chooses to die on don't make sense to me. Like, he's willing to try to coerce his girlfriend into doing a lesbian photo shoot the day after her father dies. But if she were to get dressed up in a sexy Santa Claus outfit, somehow that's awful because he was a Santa Claus. Like, somehow.
I mean, that is just one of the most amazing bits in the whole film. When he's just sort of, yeah, like you say, he's sort of trying to coerce her into, it's like literally the day after or a couple of days after.
Yes, it's like one day after.
And yeah, and just the extent that he suddenly goes from 0 to 100, where he's like, oh, what are you doing this for, you idiot? You know, it's like, he's just so angry about it. It's just so hilarious. Yeah. Love it.
The morality lines for him are very blurred. And so it's hard for me to tell where he's coming from. I like him, you know, because he's Jerry Sunquist and whatever. But but Cliff's a complicated, difficult character to like. And I only like him because I like the actor. But like, yeah, he does a lot of crazy stuff in the movie. There's one moment, though, I wanted to point out, and it's really neither here nor there, but it's a moment I really like. So one of the things about the film that I think is really interesting is the kind of the commitment by the actors. So there's some little moments in the movie that really stand out to me. One is the beginning when they have the first Santa Claus murder, not the first one in the car, but the first one at the party with Belinda Mayne's character's father getting murdered, in that Cliff and Kate actually seem like really happy-go-lucky people, and then they become not so happy-go-lucky right after that scene, and that would almost be really good writing if they had really kind of honed in on that. But one of the things that Cliff does, because Cliff's kind of a scoundrel, and he's kind of a cheap bastard, and what he does is he's like a street musician, and I'm guessing Kate has a real job and pays for everything because they have a pretty nice apartment. But like, the thing is, he's at that bar with his photographer friend named Jerry, and Jerry leaves, and one of these things that Cliff does that I love is he puts the rest of Jerry's beer in his glass, and that's such a neat, subtle moment of like what a penny pincher he is, and like it gives kind of insight into his character. And I don't know if he just did that or if there was direction, but like there's some really neat little moments. And like I said, when Kelly Baker is obviously taken aback by Powell's comments, there are these neat little touches in the film. And not only that, but Alan Lake puts in a pretty creepy performance when he's with Kelly Baker, and they've got that like kind of shadowy shot of him talking to her about like selling her body and stuff like that. And his voice is in this kind of like menacing whisper. And there are actually like these little flourishes of what could be like traditionally considered a really good film. And then it's surrounded by a lot of like kind of choppy haphazardness. But it's like there's a lot of really interesting moments in the film that the more you watch it, the more you can see where the actors are like really putting themselves out there in a lot of ways to put in a good performance. And I think also it helps that Edmund Prudhomme is kind of a natural. He just comes across as just very charismatic and laid back and really good in the role.
Yeah, he is good. I mean, you were talking about the kind of the sort of love triangle thing that's going on with him, Cliff, and Kate. One of the things that Alan Birkinshaw told me that one of the things that sort of Edmund Prudhomme kind of rewrote into the script when he was working on it was the kind of the love triangle element. Apparently, he was kind of that whole his kind of thing with Kate was his kind of device. Which is quite interesting. It's always struck me as a little bit odd. You know, it's sort of sewn in quite early on when I think they're going to, I think it's just before they go to her flat, to talk to her for the first time. And, you know, they're talking about, her and Cliff. And I think he says, pretty girl though.
Or that's something, right. Something yeah, like that's that. Right.
And it's kind of, it's odd. It kind of sort of sneaks up on you, and then, you know, sort of by the end she's sort of, I mean, kind of rightly so, I mean, Cliff has well and truly put his foot in it, and kind of understandable in a way that she's sort of looking elsewhere. But it's always struck me as a little bit odd, but yeah, it sort of would make sense based on kind of what I know of read about Edmund Prudhomme, that would kind of be his doing. Apparently there's also actually this was how we discovered that Alan Birkinshaw had a rough cut of the film that was slightly different, was because we were talking on the phone and he was commenting on a bit early on when we first meet Edmund Prudhomme's character, and he comes into the office at the police station, and some of the bobbies are reading the newspaper, and it's got his picture on the front. Basically, I was talking to Alan Birkinshaw on the phone, and he was saying, oh, yes, that line where they say he's a handsome devil, referring to his picture in the paper, he was saying that was inserted by Prudhomme himself. And I, you know, I know the film fairly well, and I was like, I don't remember that line. And then we realized that, you know, he had a different version of the film. But that just kind of says kind of a lot about Edmund Burdham's character as well, that he sort of wrote in these lines. But no, he is good. He is convincing. It's interesting on the 52-minute making of doc, seeing him, kind of apparently in his element, directing, this was, you know, presumably well before he ended up sort of, you know, being replaced on the movie. I don't know if you had any impressions from him from that doc, but, I mean, he's
a character. He's
yes, extremely eccentric.
Yeah, and really likable, and by all accounts, people loved him. He seems really charming. But one of the things he talks about that I loved and thought was really interesting was he says his fourth wife tried to kill him, but he'd only been married three times at this point, so he made up the fourth wife. and was telling this story about how he got into horror was because she tried to electrocute him or something like that. And it's really, he's spinning tails for the camera, you know what I mean? And to be fair, I mean, I think Dick Randall's doing the same thing. In that documentary, the only person who I think is kind of approaching it seriously is Steve Minasian, you know, who probably had never been in front of a camera before in his life. And it's kind of charmingly like, well, it's hard to make people laugh, but it's easier to make them scared, right? And that's why I make horror movies. And Dick Randall was just a card. And that's why he's featured in those little interstitials with the guy from Solder High talking to him while they watch the movie. But like, so there's a lot of like insight in the types of people that were working on the film. And Edward Prudhomme really coming to the forefront there as being very eccentric, and Dick Randall as well.
Mm. Yeah, evidently, I mean, Birkinshaw was saying that, you know, he was very eccentric by the time they worked on Don't Home Till Christmas together. I mean, they worked together on Birkinshaw's previous, the film he directed previously.
Invaders of the Lost Gold.
That's the one. I knew you would help me with that.
That movie. I love that movie.
So he had already worked with him on that, but I think he said by the time Don't Open Till Christmas rolled around, he was especially eccentric, and he was evidently trying to direct a dog as if he were an actor. I can't remember if the dog appears in the final cut.
No.
It's in the rough cut. It's just a very small bit where the Santa that ends up in the London dungeons climbs down the side of...
Oh,
you know, climbs down that stack of something, and at some point he's approached by a dog. But yeah, apparently Edmund Purdom was sort of trying to direct the dog and talking to it like it was a human.
Oh my gosh. If I could be a fly on the wall.
I can well imagine.
Yeah, like, it's so funny. I saw a question on Twitter yesterday that somebody asked, if you could go back in time and be on the set of any film, what would you choose? And I'm pretty sure it would be Don't Open Till Christmas.
Yeah, it would definitely be up there.
It's such a curious film, you know.
But which period would you choose? I mean, you were talking about the timeline a bit, and it's still pretty murky. I mean, I think it was Christmas 1982 when they started with Edmund Purdom. And based on, a lot of my info comes from Alan Birkinshaw, who I've spoken to at length. His sense was that Edmund Purdom actually finished, you know, as far as he was concerned, finished the film. Other sources say that he left the film, you know, due to disagreements. I think it says that in his biography that he left the film. But anyway, Alan Birkinshaw thinks that he actually finished, to all intents and purposes, the film, and it was then at that point that you know, Dick Randall and Steve Minasian looked at the film and said, "This is, you know, this is unsellable." then they brought this character, noted sexploiteer, British sexploiteer Derek Ford in. According to the notes on the Mondo Macabro disc, he was only directing. Obviously, he wrote the film. He was only directing for a couple of days and was removed due to his drinking. I don't have a source to back that up, so that's purely based on that. And I'm not sure where else the idea of Derek Ford directing comes from apart from that. But anyway, and then that's when Alan Birkinshaw came in. He had already obviously worked with Dick Randall on Invaders of the Lost Gold.
That's right.
I think actually the first time they collaborated was on Alan Birkinshaw's second film, Killer's Moon, 1978. Dick Randall was the distributor at one point, but then they ended up buying him back out of the film. But so that's how they first collaborated. So Birkinshaw, and then Dick Randall was living in Rome, and then he decided to move to London. I think it was 81. And Alan Birkinshaw helped him get his office in the famous Hammer House in central London, which is obviously used to be the headquarters of Hammer Films. So apparently Dick Randall was very pleased about having an office in Hammer House. So Birkinshaw was like around when Randall was putting this film together, and apparently he visited the set a few times. And so he was kind of, you know, there when they decided they needed someone to try to fix the film. And actually Birkinshaw kind of developed a bit of a reputation as someone that would come in and, you know, try to fix movies. I think there was a film with God, I'm going to forget his name now. There was a few films I know he mentions in the interview we did that he came in and sort of helped reshape. So yeah, so he did. He said he rewrote and reshot about 30-40 minutes of material. And then I can't remember when Rafe Self, the editor, when he comes into the mix. I think it might be again the Mondo Macabro notes. But anyway, it's kind of out there that he was also involved in directing. And interestingly, when me and Alan Birkinshaw were talking through his rough cut, one of the scenes, maybe one of the only bits that's not in it, is the flashback that we get at the end, which explains, you know, why Alan Lake has developed a pathological hatred of Santas. That scene's not in there. And Birkinshaw said he wasn't involved in it, so we can probably safely assume that that was filmed by Ray Self. So that's kind of roughly, you know, roughly what we know of the timeline. But there's still, you know, as probably clear, there's still kind of holes and kind of unexplained bits.
Yeah, that, well, there's also like for instance, there's scenes where Belinda Main is in short sleeve shirts. And it's clear because they talked about Dick Randall alluded that in that documentary that it took like a year to make the film. Other people say it took 2 years, but clearly they've gone through seasons because she's dressed for a more warmer climate. And it's only hot in England, not as many months as it is here, I think. So it went into summer at least. And like I said, I think that there's some slight differences in her hair. And there's also a scene that I didn't even notice till the last time I watched it where she's walking down the street. Matter of fact, you have it in your location extra. And she passes by people. And then at the end of the film, she gets on a phone to call Inspector Harris. But some time has passed and she'd already worn like 2 or 3 different outfits. But she's in the outfit she was in when she's walking down that street. So they cut
the double denim.
Yes, yes. So they cut that scene in half and then put it, kind of bookended him with a lot of stuff in between. And so she's dressed in all these different types of clothes and very little of it feels winter to me, you know. But at the same time, and we talked about this on the commentary, was some of the best moments in the film. You talking about how horror movies capture these certain places in time. London in 1982 or 83, whenever they shot it, is really captured well in the street shots of like the kids standing outside the stores during Christmas and Portobello Road and Piccadilly Theater, like the exterior shots, and a lot of Prudhomme just walking around. And it really captures London. And also where they chose to shoot it, because like, for instance, when Dario Argento shoots in Rome, he goes to these very beautiful, often, not always, exotic locations. But where they chose to shoot in London, they captured a lot of, like, regular parts of it, like alleys and these weird streets that you don't normally see as a tourist. So, like, it's a really interesting, in a way, travelogue of London in 1982 and 1983 that I personally really like, because growing up as a kid, I was always fascinated by England. Probably because I was really into like Duran Duran, you know, and all that stuff. And mm-hmm. it seemed like such a far off place to me. And yet it's England is very similar and very different than the States. So for me to see that kind of stuff, it was really interesting.
Yeah. And of course you get all the kind of, well, you get a taster of the kind of sleazy Soho alleyways and stuff. I think the alleyway that is sort of nominally the location for the you know, Experience Girls sex club is this sort of kind of well-known alleyway just down in Soho that's, you know, was used for a bunch of films. And now it's there's like still like a couple of sex shops there, because I know we went there because there's a grimy late 80s sort of true crime film called Cold Light of Day that I got re-released through Arrow, that's sort of very quite loosely based on serial killer Dennis Nielsen, and it's got some shots of him. It's a lot of it is set, but there's a lot of, again, that's why I love that, there's a lot of sort of similar kind of locations to Don't Open Till Christmas around Soho and kind of West End. And I just love seeing that, you know, the late 80s kind of you know, pretty sort of sleazy and kind of, you know, in the grainy footage is just, you know, it's just like being transported into a familiar but unfamiliar world. But yeah, there's that sort of alleyway that they use. Now it's, especially in the last few years, like even, not that I loiter around these alleyways too much, but in fact, in that location piece for Cold Light of Day, I did a bit where me and the director emerged from the sex shop. And yeah, it's probably one of the most awkward things I've done, which is saying something. But yeah, so you glimpse all these things in Don't Open Till Christmas. And, you know, you were saying places you don't get to see as a tourist, but even as a local, you know, I've lived here for most of my 38 years. You know, there's little bits that that I'd never been to before. So like where Pat Astley runs down that alleyway into this little place called Portland Mews, I've never been to before. It's just like, it's kind of off, you know, it's right in the heart of Soho, but unless you had a reason to go in there, there's a few like post-production houses and stuff like that, but you just wouldn't see it otherwise. So for me, I love being a tourist in my own town as well. So that was really enjoyable for me.
Yeah, it's just, I just love that aspect of the film. And so I think another aspect of the film that we both kind of fell in love with was I don't know how to word this because there's so much about it. The people, like you were talking about, the people involved in the film and how they knew each other and didn't know each other, but there's certain people involved that really came to the forefront for us, predominantly Alan Lake, being somebody that I think you and I both became really enamored with. And interestingly enough, I think we both might have fallen in love with Diana Doors, and she's not even in the movie. And
oh, absolutely. Yeah, yeah, I mean, she's, yeah, sorry, go on. But she's just yeah, just we really went on a deep dive on Alan Lake and Diana Doors. And, you know, now I want to just watch both their entire filmographies and listen to all their records. And
yes, yeah. So just to keep people who haven't listened to the commentary yet or don't know much about it, Alan Lake plays Giles in the film, and he had, and you go into depth on it, and we don't have to go in super in depth here, but he had kind of a really fascinating and tragic life. And he was an actor who got a lot of character roles, was really good, but kind of fell into this sort of like recurring character, guest star or whatever, on a lot of television, and did some sexploitation and stuff like that. And he met on a TV show, Diana Doors, I believe it was on a TV show or play, and they ended up getting married about 7 or 8 weeks after they met. And they had what seemed like a really incredible love affair. They had a child together. But they both died very young and very tragically. She was a little bit older. I think she was 8 or 9 years older than him, which in and of itself is amazing. And she died of cancer, I believe, in her early 50s. And they had a young child. And I don't know if it's been substantiated or not, but I think Alan Lake found out he was dying as well a little bit after.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I've read that he supposedly had a tumor. Huh. And I don't know if that's true or not, because I haven't seen it in all of my sources. But at any rate, he was very depressed. A lot of it came from losing his wife. And about 8 or so months after she died, he committed suicide. I believe he killed himself like on the day they had met or something, like this anniversary date. And prior to that, he'd had kind of a tumultuous life. He went to prison for about a year for getting to a bar brawl where I think somebody got murdered, but he didn't kill that person, but he was involved in the fight. And later in life, he started drinking and things were haphazard with him, but through it all, they stayed together and they had what looked like a very happy child who also died a little tragically as well, 50. He drank himself to death, basically. And like, when you read about him, it's moving. But then when you kind of start to deep dive into his life and her life, it just becomes so fascinating. And also, I think what comes through it is the fact that they really cared about each other so deeply. And also, they seem like terrific people. And so, I don't know. You just, sometimes when you do these commentaries, you fall in love with the subject or an aspect of it. And for me, what came forward was really Alan Lake. I just fell in love with him. So I started watching some of his stuff. He did a Hammer House of Mystery and Suspense, which aired here as Fox Mystery Theater. I think it was called Paint Me a Murder. And he's only in two or three scenes, but he plays this kind of like crazy artist. And he's like creating problems for this woman who's pretending like her husband had died so that they could sell his art for a phenomenal amount of money. And he's pointing things out that might kind of show that she's been lying about her husband's death. And he doesn't play a prominent role in it, but he's great. And he was also in this episode of Heart to Heart where he plays this New York cabbie. So they dubbed his voice. And I guess they hired him because they shot the episode in Greece and maybe they thought it was easier to get somebody from England to come to Greece than somebody from New York. But he's great in it and he's kind of the hero of the episode, which is really wonderful because in Heart to Heart, Belinda Main also was in another episode and she plays the villain. So they've switched roles here, right? So like in her Heart to Heart, she's the bad guy. Whereas in his Heart to Heart, he's kind of a hero in the story too. So, and he's great in it. And he's just this cab driver who drives one of the characters across this Greek island and helps him, like, you know, solve this crime or whatever. And he's fantastic. And so I haven't gone deeper than, like, I haven't gone into their sexploitation stuff yet. But but there's a, he has...
The sexploitation episode's coming up.
Yes, yes. He has had this really amazing career. And he shines in everything he's in. And he's really good in this. And so you had told me, and I think we might have talked about it in the commentary, but he wasn't originally envisioned in the film. Is that right? Didn't Burgershaw create that character?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. That was I think Burkinshaw was kind of trying to get another thing off the ground with him at the time, so he brought him onto the film. As you said, kind of Alan Lake is one of the best things about it. That's all thanks to Burkinshaw.
Yay.
That kind of begs the question, who was sort of playing the killer beforehand, or was there a killer, or, you know, this is one of the sort of enduring mysteries that we still haven't uncovered. And unless Burkinshaw's able to turn up the original script that he had to work from, we may never know. But what was really interesting and fun for me about kind of researching this film for the commentary was, you know, I've never really been kind of one to do like deep dives on cast, and with like our previous commentaries, I've just sort of, you know, nattered away and made the occasional quip. But it was really interesting to actually kind of do a deep dive into these characters, and especially, you know, kind of being a Brit, you know, there's a lot of credits, you know, that I recognize. A lot of these people were in a lot of the same like TV shows that maybe I didn't quite grow up with, because they're slightly before my time, I must say, but I'm certainly aware of. I mean, Alan Lake was in episodes of the BBC police procedural drama Z-Cars, and Juliet Bravo, which actually my father's directed, prolific TV director. He directed episodes of those, unfortunately not the same ones, but it's all these names that I recognize, you know, that are kind of sort of ingrained in my DNA a bit, so it's really interesting for me to kind of delve into them more. Kevin Lloyd, who plays the sleazy photographer, was I definitely knew him. He was like one of our best loved actors, playing the role of Tosh in the police drama The Bill, which I definitely did grow up watching, because that was on, I think, 88 till, can't remember when it finished. But it's definitely, yeah, that was definitely a tea time viewing for me. So I was very familiar with him, albeit with a moustache and more of a pot belly. he's... not exactly maybe a nice guy in the film, but he provides some of our favorite lines in the film. I was just rewatching the scene, you know, when he meets Cliff in the train station, in Marylebone train station, and it just cracks me up every time. I mean, there's so many things about his lines that crack me up, but when Cliff says, oh, you know, her dad's just been killed or whatever. Oh, whose dad's just been killed at the Christmas party. The first thing that Kevin Lloyd says was, oh, not the Christmas party. Oh, God, not the Christmas. It's like, that's the main thing. I don't know if that's like a British concern or something, but like that, like the Christmas, the office Christmas party is like, and I presume it was like, I don't know. I've made that assumption that you normally associate Christmas parties with being like an office Christmas party. So
yeah.
I don't know if that was some sort of office Christmas party. I don't think there's any more context than that.
There's not. But it's interesting. And we talked about in the commentary, it's a costume party.
Mm.
So it's like a tribute to Halloween, I think, at some point.
Mm. Yeah. I mean, that's, I love it, you know, to preface, I love it. But it's such a weird opening scene for me. Like, it's one of those kind of opening, again, talking about slasher conventions, you know, I love the kind of convention of like the opening, like the setup kill, whatever. I mean, I guess this is sort of the second setup kill we get to in quite quick succession. In fact, we get a lot of killings in quick succession in this film, which is one of the things that makes it a bit of a winner in my eyes. But that scene at the party, you know, that it takes, you sort of have to spin it back a few times to sort of realize like the way it's put together is very odd. You know, like when for example Cliff, you know, they're in the dressing room and Cliff says, you know, there's that guy with the shrunken head is putting people off their food. And it cuts to like a shot that's clearly like the mask with no one in it. Yes. It's really weird. I don't know, because then after the dad is killed with that the spear that's gone through his mouth, Cliff then like spots what he thinks is the killer and runs and grabs it, and it's like a dummy, you know, wearing the killer's outfit. So the killer's come with like a dummy of itself.
Yeah, and then like Cliff tells the police later, I've given you your first clue.
The shrunken in the head. But it's just all, I mean, I guess that's symptomatic of the film as a whole, but that whole scene is just sort of very oddly put together.
It's insight into Cliff not being the brightest bulb on the tree, I would say.
But I definitely had to spin that back a few times to sort of realize what had happened there, because it's also because you've got this party streamer coming out of the dad's mouth at the same time. So it's all just sort of like, what's, you just sort of blink and miss it. But you know, it's fabulously trashy.
Great. I love the kills in this movie, because they come without any real, with the exception of maybe the dungeon murder, there's not really a whole lot of suspense. They're just like roasting chestnuts, or they're going pee, or they're standing outside a bathroom and they get killed. And it's like, okay, we don't know anything about this person at all, except they're dressed up like Santa Claus. And now I guess the only other one might be the guy in the sex booth, who actually I love. He does seem very sweet. And there's something about that scene that's not touching, but
I love that interchange. Yeah,
she's very cute with him, and I know you were talking about, like, we're not sure whether or not she actually, her mother really owns it, or if she's just playing around with him, but she's got this really great flirty way about her that's really sweet and innocent, and then it becomes like, oh, would you like me sitting on your lap raring to go?
Yeah, what, and there's that line about, you know, all, was it, I don't know what you're going to do with, you know, having had kiddies on your knee all day. Pretty off key.
But he seems like such a sweet guy. And and so
no, it's just we just get a bit of extra in that scene, don't we? Where it's, you know, it just gives her a bit of interesting kind of characterization. Like, what's she, that she's sort of messing around with him? Is she sort of, is there kind of a bit of malice there? Is it just kind of playful? She's just having a bit of a laugh, you know. Does she work for her mom? It's kind of, it just kind of adds an interesting little kind of ripple to her character, which I very much appreciate.
Yeah, and I also like the Santa, the really overweight Santa that's at the market, and the really beautiful blonde walks by, and she smiles, and he makes this face, and then he looks at the ornament like, okay, this is what you're going to get.
What I love about that is his line is cut off. He obviously says something in response to her walking past, just before he sort of shrugs his shoulders and looks at the ball ball. But it's obviously, as a lot of this, we discovered a lot of this film was shot without sound. So they obviously shot it without sound, but the poor guy thought he was going to get a line.
Aww.
Only to have it cut off, which is obviously not the only thing that gets cut
off. Yeah, I was just going to say, yikes.
I don't know. Do you think? I mean, I kind of love the haphazard way, just kind of killings come and go. Would you have liked to see a bit more characterization, a la the guy in the booth? Do you think that would have enhanced things a bit for you?
That's a good question. It depends. If they were all like the guy in the booth, then yes. But if we're just really going to follow them around, just to follow them around, I mean, they'd have to give them. That would be a lot of work because there's a bunch of people getting killed in this.
Mm.
And so I don't think it would service the film unless they came in with really good writing for all of the Santas, and I think that would be impossible. So
yeah, I might have liked, you know, like a little bit of a lead in to each of them. I mean, that said, it's one of the things that just kind of I sort of love about the film is just you know the random, you know, the chestnut death and the Santa getting his brains blown out. You know, I kind of love the sort of randomness of it.
It's a little bit like Killer Workout. You know how like nobody quits working out at the gym, even though like 10 people have been murdered. And now it's like, I'm still going to dress up like Santa Claus.
Yeah.
Even though I know that Santa Clauses are being targeted and murdered, like tons of them.
Yeah.
Like Giles was serious. And I don't know why that year he decided to escape and go on a rampage, but like he made the best of it. And like, it's pretty amazing because it's literally, they talk about there's 3 more killing days till Christmas or whatever. And he's like, oh gosh, there's 3 more killing days. So I better get to work. And so in a 72-hour period, he just annihilates the Santa population. It's a sight to behold. So yeah, there's a lot of things about the movie that are really charming. And I think people who even don't know stuff about the background of it will enjoy it because I think there is something to be said for these kind of weird, strange movies that don't come out completely right and have this kind of like air about them that make them sort of unique or different. And it's never boring.
No, absolutely not.
Yeah,
no.
So they put it together correctly for what they had. You know, like the pacing of the film is like crazy. So, it's fine the way it is. But I do like those moments, like you said, like with that Santa in the booth, you know. But I don't know that the film needed to have that throughout. I guess there wouldn't be enough time for the love triangle that they dropped or the 3 red herrings that they have. You know, they needed all that.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, it's really interesting looking at the rough cut. It gives you an idea. I mean, we've included the most interesting scenes on the Vinegar Syndrome release. And a lot of the film is the rough cut is silent, so it wouldn't have really worked to include the whole thing. It's not particularly watchable. But it's very interesting. It kind of just emphasizes how much of a patchwork this film is because a lot of the scenes have been moved around, and it just I assume it's not that typical even in a low budget film. You know, you tend to have a kind of a beginning, middle and end. You know, you couldn't move, you know, the second part of the prey into the first and whatnot, but it's so episodic and it's just so emphasized by the fact that in the rough cut, like a bunch of the scenes are like in totally different order. I think like two of like the Santa kind of the chestnut Santa and the gun Santa, as we'll call him. I can't remember what his credit is. They're sort of like back to back, which is really weird. And then, you know, just I think Alan Lake kind of appears quite a bit later. Like the Caroline Monroe's bit comes quite a bit earlier,
yeah,
I think.
It does.
It's a really interesting insight. And it's like one of those little puzzles with the little shapes that they move around to try and make it fit, you know.
It is interesting. I should mention here that a couple years ago, the Alamo Drafthouse showed a work print of Slaughter High.
Oh, wow. Interesting.
Yeah. And I don't recall any of it being that different. Huh. Like nothing stood out to me when I watched it. And so it is interesting, I guess, and I didn't even think about that to even mention it, but like in terms of comparison, I think you're right. I don't think work prints normally are that different because it's a work print. No. You're working with it, but it's not like a puzzle at that point, like where you're editing it together. It should be like close to what you want to work with, right? So, like, it's interesting. I'm guessing Slaughter High went off with less of a frenzied kind of pattern to the filmmaking or production history.
No, I mean, they just brought the three directors in from the start.
Yeah, that's right. So, they have multiple directors in that too as well.
They're just like, you know, let's not wait. Let's just bring them all together.
But yeah, there was, it was very much like the final cut of the film, which I just rewatched just because I have to watch all my Dick Randall movies now. But
well, that's a fantastic slasher.
But yeah, I, there are things about the work print that I liked. I kind of liked the timeline of it. I liked Kelly Baker and Alan Light showing up a little later. I don't mind them showing up in what we ended up with. That's fine. And I like it going back and forth between all the characters. But it was interesting to see it has kind of almost more linear sort of structure to it.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I'm sure I'll go back and compare them again. But I'm not sure in the rough cut the sense makes that much. The order makes a huge amount of sense, but there's obviously some bits that were taken out, which are very tantalizing. And of course, one of the key bits in the rough cut is the Dr. Bridal scene, which had kind of long been the source of some
folklore. I mean, it was myth, urban legend, you know?
Yeah. And because a Dr. Bridal is referred to in the Finnish film, and but the character is credited in the end credits with actor Nicholas Donnelly attached to the character. So from that, I think people were, or at least IMDb were, wondering, you know, where this possible missing Dr. Bridal scene had gone. And of course, when first thing I did when I got the rough cut was zip right forward to that scene, and there he was.
Yeah, it's so interesting because they go as far as to show Kate at Parklands.
Well, Parklands is actually the same bit of pavement where Kelly Baker is pulled down to the lair. We discovered when we're there, it's literally a few yards on. They just use the different, because you can see it's the same railings, these quite distinctive railings.
Yeah.
They just stuck a sign on it.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's kind of, you know, they went to, it doesn't really make sense. Yeah, I guess I'm not quite sure why they included the bit of her in the waiting room.
Yeah, it's an interesting, because then they just go to something else. I guess to show that she was putting the pieces together, and I guess they figured that they could just have her, because she sort of explains it at the end when she's being confronted by Giles, what she uncovered. So maybe they just figured that they could cut some time off it, and she's going to just re-explain what happened anyway.
Yeah. But the staff at the Parklands Mental Hospital are probably about as inept, or maybe even more inept than the staff in Silent Madness. In terms of she's so in the scene, you know, Belinda Kate goes in and talks to Dr. Bridal about the fact that Inspector Harris has been visiting his brother, who's you know, being held there, let's say, and the doctor just sort of adds kind of off the cuff towards the end, oh yes, so unfortunately we actually misplaced the brother last week. I think yeah, that's misplaced. The exact wording. And he's just all a bit like, oh yes, what a to do. It's just hilarious.
That's so funny.
But yeah, so yeah, I don't know if that's one of the reasons they took it out, because it's just pretty silly. See, one of the things I find most intriguing about the rough cut, and this kind of little theory that I'm kind of building up, is that somehow Edmund Purdom is implicated in the killings, because that's what all the signs yes. point to. And if you watch the rough cut and pay attention, all the signs point to that. So, you know, in the scene with the doctor, Dr. Bridal says, you know, Kate asked them if they knew, I think, anyway, it transpires that, you know, the brother is obsessed with Santa, I think, or Christmas. And the doctor says, when Kate asks if they drew a line between the brother being obsessed with Santa and the Santa killings, he says, oh yes, we did consider that, but apparently the police felt otherwise, which is an odd an odd little comment, which for me kind of seems to suggest that, like, you know, the police have, you know, that the police and by implication Purdom's character have sort of somehow sort of tried to downplay it. You know, maybe he's like protecting the brother, or, you know, at best protecting the brother, or at worst somehow involved. But then I think it's slightly earlier on in the rough cut, a scene which is in the film, the finished film, when Sergeant Powell finds Giles, I'm going French here, finds Giles snooping around the police station, when he happens upon him in their office. Which again, I don't know how you just wander into Scotland Yard. People seem to wander in and out of places in this film. Maybe London was a lot more open in the 80s, I'm not sure. But yeah, Sergeant Powell comes across Giles snooping around the office. And so in that scene, but in the rough cut, there's an extended bit at the end when Giles has gone and Giles is saying, you know, you want to look into Inspector Harris. Sergeant Powell has a rootle around a filing cabinet under Inspector Harris's desk, and he happens across a transparent mask, much like the one that we worn by the killer. So those two combined to me suggests, like, part of the original intention was that Inspector Harris was somehow implicated. And I don't know if in kind of rewriting and kind of introducing the Alan Lake character, they wanted to sort of tone down the implication that Inspector Harris is involved somehow. I mean, we know Alan Birkinshaw didn't film the Dr. Bridal scene, so we know that the character of the brother was always in there and was probably always the main culprit. But it seems like in his reworking it, they decided maybe there was this element of Inspector Harris being involved, and they decided for whatever reason to take that out.
I'll be honest. I think it's the housekeeper, because so at the beginning, when she's talking to him, he says he has to go to work. And then she says, maybe he'll show me the photos later, implicating that she likes to look at the bloodshed. And then she tells Kate about Parklands, and then says, don't tell him I told you about this mental hospital and his brother. And then in the work print, there's this scene with her building a bomb, right, at the end, and Inspector Harris is killed by a bomb. And so I kind of think that the housekeeper was intended to be maybe not the killer, but somebody very important in that aspect.
Yeah, that was very bizarre when I got to the end of the rough cut, and there's this little sequence where she's calling what we presume is Inspector Harris's replacement, and she's, you know, she's going to be his housekeeper, which seems a bit like she's kind of doing herself out of a job there if she's just got a new gig as a housekeeper, but she's making a bomb for the person she's going to be the housekeeper for. It's not what she does. Maybe not the best kind of business practice, but yeah, I mean, it's clear she's involved from the rough cut. But yeah, no, it's interesting. You mentioned that comment where she's saying, oh, I wonder if he'll show me the photos or whatever. Cause I never thought twice about that. You know, it's a little colorful, you know, she's like it's a little off color, which I kind of appreciated, but I didn't, you know, obviously until I saw that, scene in the rough cut, didn't get the full implication of that. But there's little bits like that, you know, you said it's one that we enjoy coming back to. I mean, even just watching the film, just got past the scene where Giles calls Sergeant Powell, you know, and says, does he want some info to solve the case? And I think Sergeant Powell says, I'm just reading the headlines. Are you responsible? And I think Giles says something like, yes, well, sort of, which... Yes, then watching back, I'm like, oh, that's actually really interesting, because he's like, yeah, I'm sort of responsible, but not in the way you think, which...
Yeah.
So, you know, I'm not saying it's high art and it's all, you know, incredibly thought through, but there are these little nuggets that that you find on subsequent viewings.
Absolutely, yeah. I think that there are some really clever, fun moments. And while you were talking about that, one of the things that stuck out to me is... I think some of the most successful aspects of the film are the parts that seem to come from the sexploitation roots of the filmmaker. So like the stuff with Sharon is really great. And we talked about the Kelly Baker in the booth of being playful with the Santa. And anything that has some kind of like fun kind of sexual allusion to it. Like there's even that moment at the beginning where the dad is like, I look like a gay old queen.
Mm.
And then Kate's trying to help him with his Santa makeup. And then Cliff comes in and he says, you look like a gay old queen.
Yeah.
And like, there's this real, there's a playfulness in the film and it doesn't follow through the whole thing, but there are these moments. And I kind of feel like when, since all the filmmakers were actually so entrenched in this other genre before they moved over to horror, it feels like that they had sort of perfected that sort of genre and they were able to incorporate some really neat little moments into this film that feel rooted in what they were doing. And it's interesting because they were all interested or all were working in this kind of British sexploitation market in the 70s. We were talking about how Dick Randall was kind of like a deal maker and Stephen Asian was clearly a money man. They weren't like necessarily creative forces in the films. But like how there was this group of filmmakers, Derek Ford being really prominent in there, making these kinds of movies because they were popular at the time. And then they stopped being so popular. So they looked at what's popular now? Oh, slashers. And they move over, right? And it's really interesting the way they were kind of hopscotching over to different trends and then trying to perfect or figure out what the formula was that would make these films marketable.
Yeah, and often not getting it right, but in really fascinating ways.
Yeah, and so I just find like you can see the roots of their other work in this film. And so that's another thing about when you deep dive into these filmmakers, you start to see these things.
Yeah.
And those elements for the film really work for me. All the really cute, playful, sexy stuff, which there's not a ton of, but there's enough in there that I can see where it came from and where the filmmakers were coming from that I really like.
Yeah. I mean, like you said, there's a handful of scenes in this that, you know, could easily have been from, you know, a 70s kind of Brit sexploitation. You know, obviously the stuff with Pat Astley, and obviously that's, you know, she was kind of sort of known for that. But, you know, the scene where they go and, you know, you were almost arrested for indecent exposure, you know, when
that's right.
Bodum, you know,
I'm a professional.
Raises his finger at her.
That's right, he does. He's so good in that scene.
But yeah, that whole bit could just easily be lifted out of, you know, 70s sex comedy and, you know, pretty much anything with Pat Astley, you know, apart from maybe the switchblade being run down her chest. But
and even there, she's great. Like, yeah. That's like a really, like, so the camera shot, Alan Pudney shot this film, and I don't know that much about his career, but he, like I talked about, the street shots are really great. But one of the shots that I really like is the shot of her trying to hide in the corner in that alley, and she's kind of in the corner of the frame, and then there's the alley right there, and she looks terrified, and it's a really nicely framed shot. And I feel like the horror scene with her, you know, where the killer comes up in the mask with the razor, is really well done, and she looks terrified and very cold, by the way. And what a trooper she is for doing the stuff that she did back then. But like, that's like a really well done scene.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah. And that's the thing, that the film kind of surprises you now and again with a genuinely kind of effective scene. And that's definitely one of them. I really like the, you know, the sort of, is it Silent Night? I think it's kind of synthy Silent Night, yes, playing in the background while he's doing that. And it's actually genuinely creepy. You can't really ever go wrong with a transparent mask, but that and the kind of the anorak thing and the, you know, Des Dolan's synthy Silent Night just is all sort of makes it actually very kind of creepy and intense. Yeah. And I think, and you then, know, the, go on, sorry.
No, I was just going to say, and then Des Dolan's, I one thing I should have mentioned on the commentary is I talked about him as the film composer, but they use a lot of library music.
Mm.
It sounds like, so like when they're like revealing something, it's like there's this like almost like piano player 20s, da-da!
Mm.
You know, kind of going on, and then they're like, that's supposed to be really scary, and then you're like, that's not that scary, Des Dolan.
And obviously Des Dolan is a very interesting character. I mean, I sort of knew of his work without really knowing of him, and obviously you dug up a lot on him, and it was interesting to delve back into that world. And always enjoy reading about the Video Nasty era.
It's interesting because, and we talked about it in the commentary, so we don't have to go too deep into it, but this idea that they were filming the movie during the era of the Video Nasty, but it kind of came out at like the tail end when everything was calming down. And although I do think it ended up in England with 2 minutes of cuts or something like that. Is that correct?
Yeah, just over 2 minutes, I think, yeah.
That's a lot. And but the furor of the Video Nasties, I think, had kind of died down at that point. But just Dolan was actually like the father of the movement because he thought it would be really fun promotion to send, what's her name, Mary...
Whitehouse.
I almost said Whitehead, and I'm like, that's not right. To send her a copy of Cannibal Holocaust as like kind of promotion and free promotion for his video company. And she ran with it, and it created an insane kind of like moral panic in your country. And it's actually all because of the Dolan. And he was actually a music producer prior to that, and had owned a music house. I think it was called Hammer Studio, but not, I don't think it was associated with Hammer Studios. Like, I think it was just called Hammer Records or something. And so he was like, when I read about him, they were calling him an entrepreneur, but he was really, again, sort of like
a hustle merchant.
Yeah. He's sort of like Randall, right? He was sort of looking at like where he could make money and finding like what the trends were. Oh, like I could release these exploitation movies. And he was really good at creating lurid poster art and stuff like that.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, like, yeah. So through his Go Video, they released Cannibal Holocaust and SS Experiment Camp, and with like extremely lurid covers, and those are probably like amongst two of the most memorable of the kind of Video Nasties covers. And you know, he was, you know, a huge promoter of his product. I think he took out like full page ads in trade magazines to promote both those films. And you know, it's by no accident that both those films became, you know, like, you know, the poster boys, you know, the whipping boys for the anti-Video Nasty campaign in the UK.
Yeah, so it's really interesting that he was involved in this film, you know, and how it was actually produced through this whole thing. And they were conscious of it because Randall commented on it in the documentary, The Making of a Horror Film, whatever it was called, about like he was going to have a Margaret Thatcher impersonator on there, like to sort of clarify things or to maybe make smooth things out or whatever. He was joking about it. And he was aware of everything that was happening in England at the time. And so I just, the connections there are so fascinating to me. And Des Dolan has his little cameo at the end too, which is one of my favorite scenes, is when they get to Kate's apartment and she's been murdered, and Pal's over her body, and he says to Des Dolan, he says, check the apartment quick. And then Des Dolan walks away as slow as possible.
And he calls him Des as well.
He does. And I love it. I love it. I love that there's cameos. Derek Ford is a cameo.
Yeah.
You were telling on the commentary, you mentioned Alan Bergenshaw's voice shows up at the opening scene with the couple in the car.
Yeah.
And like, I love, and he's also apparently in that newspaper. And well,
Bergenshaw was also, he told me he was also played the killer when the killer was chasing Kelly. And when he grabs her as well, that's Bergenshaw, yeah.
Oh, that's so great. Yeah, so I love how they all kind of filtered in and out. And I wanted to really briefly talk about Ray Self's scene. And because we talked about it on the commentary, but it's still really fascinating because it has there's no credits for the who appears in that. And whoever they hired to play Giles, they nailed it because he's really off-centered. That kid is a great performance. But also, it's got this really enigmatic kind of nightmarish, which makes sense because it's a dream sequence, but it's got this very dreamy quality to it that's so different from the rest of the film, and it's eerie and weird.
It kind of puts me in mind of like a, you know, to mention again, a Pieces or kind of Nightmares in a Damaged Brain or Nightmares, You Guys Had It. And there's actually another connection there that I'll mention in a minute. But it definitely puts me in mind, as quite a bit of the film does, but particularly that. It's just got this kind of queasy sort of otherworldly quality to it that puts me in mind of those type of films.
Yeah, and it makes sense because Ray Self, we didn't get to talk about him too much, but he was a huge cinephile, and he was actually a projectionist as a teenager, and he created a mobile cinema for teenagers. And he taught classes on filmmaking, mm-hmm. and cut trailers. And I think he owned a theater at some point too, which was located in Piccadilly Square. And he fell into exploitation because he was known for making things cheaply. So where Birkinshaw came in to clean things up, Self was known for like, we need you to get this done and as cheaply as possible. And I found this great quote of him in a newspaper where he said, I told London Weekend that I had a producer, a director, an editor, a title writer, a track layer, and a neck cutter. What I omitted to say was that they were all me. Yeah. And that's kind of what he did. And so he would go on. I think he was the one who went on. I can't remember. Yeah, he became a film archive curator. And he loved musicals and dramas. And so I think whereas I look at the rest of the film and I see people making a horror movie, I think Ray Self was making a movie that Ray Self wanted to make. Like, it feels so unique to the rest of the film that it kind of feels like it was his chance to come in and kind of do something the way Self would want to do it.
Mm.
And it stands out to me, and it's one of my favorite moments in the film. It's just really eerie and weird.
Mm. Yeah, you were mentioning that he owned cinemas at one point. That's where the connection with Nightmares and a Damaged Brain comes in, and again a video nasty connection. But he was working at one point, I think in the '70s, with Britain's self-proclaimed king of sexploitation, David Hamilton Grant. He worked together with his company Oppidan, and they were like, I think they owned cinemas, and they were a distributor as well, and Hamilton Grant, they sort of parted ways in the late 70s, early 80s, and Hamilton Grant went on to be another one of these video nasty pioneers. He set up his label World of Video 2000, and he was, I think, the only person to end up being imprisoned for distributing a video nasty. He was given prison time for distributing Nightmares and a Damaged Brain.
Oh, yikes. Really?
And similar to Des Dolan, he promoted the release. This kind of thing Des Dolan would have done. He promoted the release with a competition to guess the weight of a quote-unquote real damaged brain.
Well?
And that landed him in prison for his troubles. I think he served a year or something.
Oh, my gosh.
A year or, in the region of a year,
That's crazy.
But yeah, I think Ray Self, he, as you said, he went on to be a noted film archivist.
Yes.
He and his the erotic section of his archive popped up in the Channel 4 documentary called 100 Years of Hardcore.
Oh my gosh. Wow, that's amazing.
His obituary in The Guardian, which I think maybe you got that quote from, was written by David McGillivray, who wrote some of Pete Walker and Norman J. Warren's films and some sexploitation stuff as well.
Oh, that's amazing. Wow. Yeah. So again, there's all this like connection to like, we were talking about this too. Like, so England, I think, has a much smaller film community. So it's probably inevitable that you're going to get as much crossover as you do. But it is interesting. The interconnections are like amazing. They just keep growing. Like just what you said there added like a whole other element to the film, which makes it even more amazing, anyway, the flashback scene to me is like, I think the fact that there are no credits, so like,
yeah, and I actually keep forgetting that bit exists, and then I get to it and I'm always kind of a bit surprised.
Yeah, it's amazing. It made me think of, you were talking about The Slayer, and you know, for years there were no credits to that film, and I have a copy of it on VHS. It was a double feature with Scalps. And I don't think that there's any credits in the film. And so when I discovered that movie, it made it even creepier that I couldn't identify anybody associated with it.
Mm.
Like, I'd never seen the actors in anything before or since. Mm. And I didn't even know who directed it. And so it was this weird... It's obviously not a very realistic film. I mean, it's a monster movie. But there's something about the not knowing.
Mm.
That adds another element to it. And so I appreciate the Self addition, because it's just the fact that it just kind of pops up, like you said, kind of unexpectedly. And then there's no other association with it.
Yeah.
It makes it kind of eerie to me.
Hmm.
So that's my two cents on that.
Yeah, yeah. No, no, it's very odd. And like I said, it has that kind of flavor of Nightmares and a Damaged Brain and such. Do you think that was kind of, that little scene was taking a leaf out of, you know, Christmas Evil's book?
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, I don't really know that the filmmakers were looking at other films when they made this. I think that they were just like, oh, we need a couple of naked people and some gory set pieces and we'll be fine. But yeah, it clearly is a cousin to Christmas Evil. Christmas Evil, of course, though, is very different too at the same time. But yeah, I think that the motivation there is
Christmas
rooted.
Evil is kind of, from recollection, a bit more of a kind of a very downbeat sort of character piece that...
Yeah, but to be fair, Silent Night, Deadly Night, while it has a different flash, I guess it's a flashback or whatever, however the film opens with that, with the rape and the murder of the parents, it's all rooted in like this kind of confusion of sex and violence.
Mm.
And what's so interesting to me about Don't Open Till Christmas is I can't figure out why he let Sharon live when he clearly kills women too, and she was dressed like Santa.
Yeah. Yeah, that is bizarre. Because I mean, I'm still not sure whether we count Kelly Baker, but obviously, undoubtedly.
I'm counting her.
Okay. I know you're very attached to that idea, so we'll go with that. But that is odd as well. You know, and that, again, is kind of like multiple killers at work here. Will we ever know?
So I mean, I don't know, is there anything else you want to add?
I think between ourselves we've pretty much covered it. I can't think of anything else really. Do we want to talk about sort of ideal kind of double bill for this movie perhaps?
Yeah, I've been thinking about it because I didn't really prep a title, but I think because we mentioned it, I'm going to go with Invaders of the Lost Gold, and I'm going to go with it for a couple of reasons. One, because it's a Birkinshaw Randall collaboration with Edmund Perdomo, and what I love about the movie, so it's a jungle film, not a cannibal movie, but it's kind of a jungle adventure with Stuart Whitman, Edmund Perdomo, Laura Gemser, and so it's got this terrific cast. And it also, again, has interesting women in it. There are two women in it that sort of have this interesting friendship before one of them doesn't make it to the end. And it made me think of this film, too, where somehow, despite the fact that I think Dick Randall didn't care about having dynamic women in his movies, he somehow managed to still have dynamic women in his movies. And I really liked the two women in that film. And also, I think... of all the Edmund Perdomo kind of B-movies that I've watched, and I watched a couple of these to prep, like Absurd is one that I quite like. But he looks like he's having a blast. He's like this bad guy in it, and he's cigar chomping through the whole thing, and he's really aggressive, and he's fun. He's really fun. And I think he loved doing it, because I think he often plays these kind of like very buttoned up kind of characters.
Yeah.
And here he kind of just gets to be like a bad guy, and I loved it, and I'm not a big jungle epic person at all, but I thought it was really fun. It was a lot more coherent than I thought it was going to be. I just thought overall it was a really entertaining film, and so I think people, when they think of Dick Randall in this era, they're going to think of Pieces and Slaughter High, and those would probably make good companions as well. But I kind of think Invaders of the Lost Gold might be a fun sort of deep dive into like just where Dick Randall was spreading himself all over to kind of see where he could market these films and sell them. He was really good at making product that he could put out in all these different types of genres. And he made things that were a lot of fun. And that might be a good, not often recommended title.
I'd throw Absurd out there. I wasn't really aware of Edmund Perdomo and his pedigree, you know, the first time I watched Absurd many years ago. So it was fun revisiting it in the midst of, you know, researching Don't Open Till Christmas. And I'd forgotten what, you know, that he has quite a substantial role in that film. He's first seen for those that don't know, Absurd is a sort of quasi follow-up to Joe D'Amato's Anthropophagus, and Absurd opens with the Beast, played by, what's the actor's name again?
Luigi Montefiore or Georgie Smith.
There you go. We've given us both of them. That's double points. I
love him.
But it opens with him being chased by Edmund Purdom, and Purdom is, you know, features fairly prominently throughout as this sort of Greek priest who's kind of providing the exposition for Luigi Montefiore's character. So I definitely think that would be a fun bill, and I think, you know, we've spoken about Don't Open Till Christmas and its identity as kind of a British film, and I think I've heard it described quite often as an international slasher, and I think that is very much what it is. So I favour anything kind of with a kind of a transatlantic kind of European kind of flavour to it. And then of course Pieces is kind of a no-brainer double bill here for me as well, obviously with Dick Randall and Steve Minasian, and of course Edmund Purdom, although I've kind of ruined it for people who haven't seen it, but Edmund Purdom is, you know, plays a kind of a, it's kind of feels like a very you know, they feel like cousins, his two roles in that and Don't Open Till Christmas, so I think I would put my vote for those two.
Yeah, that's good. I also wanted to mention, because I was looking at my notes here, and Giuseppe Ferranti, who did the special effects, or the gore, I guess, in Don't Open Till Christmas, also worked on Absurd. So he worked with Perdomo, so that's kind of a good recommendation, because now we're going back to this idea of people with these kind of interconnections, you know? And so I just thought of that when you said that. He also worked on Devilfish and other movies, but there you go. Okay, so this is the first episode. I'm not sure what we're doing next. This is still a work in progress, but we're really excited to sit here and talk about these crazy slashers and how amazing they are and why they're amazing and about the people involved in them. And again, my name is Amanda Reyes.
And I'm Ewan Kant.
And thanks so much for listening.
Don't open till Christmas. If you do, you may not see in the new year.